Hello, and thanks for turning on The Blender, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's podcast. I'm Bruce Jacobs, a producer at RFERL, and I'll be your host this week for episode 52 of our program. Every week, we release a special blend of features and analysis, so that means a full year has gone by. Check back next week for our special look at the very best of The Blender from 2011. In this episode, a torturous tale from Afghanistan. A teenage newlywed is rescued after 6 months of horrific abuse at the hands of her husband's family. But first, an in-depth look at Afghanistan's northern neighbor, Uzbekistan. In a report released in December, Human Rights Watch said Uzbekistan has failed to provide its citizens with basic legal rights, and that Western governments seeking closer ties with the authoritarian Central Asian regime have all but ignored the abuses. Human Rights Watch's Uzbekistan researcher Steve Swerdlow was forced out of the country last year. He came to RFERL's headquarters in Prague to talk about the human rights abuses in Uzbekistan and his personal experiences there with veteran Central Asia correspondent Bruce Panier.
You were denied accreditation in Uzbekistan in 2011 and were forced to leave the country. Later, an Uzbek court ordered Human Rights Watch office in Uzbekistan to be closed. Could you please give us your interpretation of the Uzbek government's reasons behind these moves?
Well, Human Rights Watch was in Uzbekistan for almost 15 years. And I think the obvious reason was our criticism of the government, our recommendations about the need to improve the human rights situation. I was denied accreditation on Christmas Eve of 2010. I was summoned to the Ministry of Justice, where I was handed a letter that looked very similar to letters that my predecessors have received before when they were denied accreditation. And the letter said that I was deemed not to have sufficiently cooperated, or actually have experience cooperating with Uzbekistan, and that Human Rights Watch has repeatedly violated the law in Uzbekistan. But of course, notably, there was an absence of any particular law in the letter, and it was pretty clear that this was similar to an earlier letter received 2 years before by my predecessor, and his letter stated that he did not understand the Uzbek mentality or culture or traditions. And we took great pains, obviously, when I was applying to stress that I had studied Uzbek, that I was a lawyer with years of experience in the region and on working on human rights issues. And I also took great pains to meet and request meetings with a wide array of Uzbek government officials. And that didn't change the result. And I think it didn't change the fact that the denial of accreditation came on Christmas Eve when the U.S. Embassy and all the other embassies had closed, when the media would be the least likely to react to that situation. And I, rather than oppose that, I had to leave the country because my visa was also ending at that time and had to leave within 24 hours. And since that time, Uzbek government officials have said that they have no problem with Human Rights Watch. It's just the people you keep sending us. But of course, I think that argument also doesn't hold water given what happened in June when the Uzbek government, the Supreme Court, actually in a probably 5 or 10 minutes hearing, decided to liquidate Human Rights Watch as a local organization, taking away our registration, ending our 15-year presence in the country officially.
Mm-hmm. Just one quick follow-up. As far as you know, you were the last foreign-based NGO, we'll say, that was still operating in Uzbekistan, certainly rights, as far as rights issues.
As a human rights organization, yes. Of course, there's an NGO called the National Democratic Institute, which is an American-funded, American government-funded NGO, which does operate in Uzbekistan and does some programming. But certainly, I think Human Rights Watch was the last standing independent international organization in a long line of organizations that have been forced out of the country and media outlets such as RFERL.
Well, you knew something about the history of the Uzbek government when you took the post to go there and head the HRW office in Tashkent. What in particular still managed to surprise you when you actually started working there?
Well, almost immediately upon my arrival to Tashkent, my phone started ringing off the hook. I was getting calls from human rights activists, lawyers, journalists, regular people that knew the phone number of Human Rights Watch that wanted to speak about their experiences, despite the fact that they likely understood that those phone calls were probably being recorded, that we were likely under some sort of surveillance. People were coming out of the woodwork to tell their stories to me. I was surprised that despite an atmosphere of a certain level of fear that you can that's almost palpable in Uzbekistan, that still lots of people are yearning to tell their stories, want to speak not only about human rights violations that take place, but the everyday trials and tribulations of life in Uzbekistan, that it's an isolated place with so little contact with the outside world, that someone like me coming in was an opportunity for people to reach beyond, reach outside of a country that doesn't let them do that. And I was simply amazed by the courage of the people I met, the hospitality of everyone I met. And even there were moments when Uzbek government officials, in sort of offhanded remarks and a few situations throughout the weeks when I would go to different ministries, and certainly when I was checking up about the status of Human Rights Watch's office and our ability to work there, when different officials would sort of, hint at the fact that they hoped that maybe there would be an opportunity that Human Rights Watch would stay. You could tell that there wasn't necessarily a monolithic response to us. There wasn't necessarily, whatever official propaganda or official position there is, or whatever the view of the security services or the prosecutor general happen to be about NGOs in the country. There are others, even some in the government, that understand the need to open up the society, that want that to happen. And so it's a lot more nuanced, I think, on the ground in Uzbekistan than it can sometimes seem.
Before 9/11, Western governments, particularly the U.S. government, were not shy in criticizing the Uzbek government, and this criticism seemed to be in step with HRW's views on the rights situation in Uzbekistan. Now, due to security concerns, these same governments are not as vocal in their criticism. How, in your opinion, has that affected the work of HRW in Uzbekistan and Central Asia in general?
Well, I think we've seen some monumental changes certainly in U.S. policy. Just a few months ago, the Senate included a waiver provision into longstanding prohibitions on selling military aid to the Uzbek government. And, it may be just a symbolic amount of military aid that eventually gets sold to the Uzbek government, but it was had a very powerful symbolic impact, I think, and sent a very strong message to the Uzbek government that Uzbekistan is now in a different category in terms of U.S. policy. It's no longer considered a sort of serial violator of human rights, despite the human rights reporting that the State Department puts out every year on Uzbekistan, cataloging its horrific record. Moves like that, I think, have seriously undercut the civil society in Uzbekistan, the remnants, you could say, of independent civil society that want the West to be more vocal, more public about the criticism that they have, the serious human rights concerns that they have. I think that there's been a move towards quiet diplomacy and constructive engagement. And while those tools may be effective on certain levels, I think that alone will not help the situation. You need to combine constructive engagement with public criticism, vocal criticism. I'll give you one example. In the end of 2010, when I was in Uzbekistan, Secretary Clinton made a visit to the country. This was the visit before her visit this year in 2011. And she made a remark when she was leaving Kazakhstan, the OSCE summit, on her way to Uzbekistan, where she said that no country can be truly free when it imprisons human rights defenders. And, just immediately after those comments, within maybe a day or so, I was contacted by a human rights activist that was released, that had been imprisoned for 2 years. And it appeared very, very much to be connected to those statements. That showed the power of public diplomacy, of a firm stance on what's happening in Uzbekistan. It showed the need to do that more. And I think our work has become more and more difficult as security interests and cooperation on Afghanistan has taken precedence over human rights. But I think that's a short-term goal that will lead to major problems for the West, ultimately, with Uzbekistan, that eventually a transition will come. We don't know when that's going to be. Eventually, the sort of discontent in the country will emerge. And what side will the United States be on? What side will the European Union be on? They should, if not from a moral and human rights standpoint, I think it's important that they at least position themselves to be in place for that transition. And the policy that's currently being followed isn't going to do that for them. Of course, also Obama. He gave an amazing speech in May about the Arab Spring. And you can take the lines from that speech that talk about the need to support the yearning of peoples for democracy in authoritarian regimes. And he was referring, of course, to the Middle East and North Africa. But you could take those lines and you could transfer them very easily to Central Asia, and especially Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan. And why is it that that contradiction should continue? It doesn't seem to make sense. And again, as I say, I think it's a short-term view. So our work is difficult. Of course, not being in Uzbekistan makes it harder. And we hope that will change eventually. We continue to believe that it's important that the international community place emphasis on the access of international independent monitors, the UN experts that can't get into the country for almost a decade now. That is a real problem. That issue of access, in addition to all the other issues, torture, religious freedom, lack of freedom of expression, improper elections. That issue of the closure of Uzbekistan, I think, should be dealt with, and it should be put on the table and on the agenda of the international community.
Okay, I just want to follow up a little bit more with your specific example of Human Rights Watch. you guys have been in, you were in the country for a while. You were tolerated but largely ignored. But correct me if I'm wrong, we were the third head of the HRW office since 2007, I believe. Can you speak a little bit about what had happened 2007 to now and the changes, the pressure on your organization within Uzbekistan?
The pressure grew as more and more organizations were being kicked out of Uzbekistan in the aftermath of Andijan. It became harder and harder for Human Rights Watch to deal with the situation, you know, both on a sort of personnel level and just the pressure, sometimes the harassment, the surveillance that you deal with on the ground in Tashkent. I mean, my predecessors that were there in 2007 dealt with, you know, it was a time when human rights activists were being imprisoned left and right. Now it's a little bit different in the sense that such a large group of civil society was put away and many fled the country. Now there's a sort of more quiet harassment and intimidation that has become very effective. But, you know, there were a lot of challenges to that work. Security was always a problem for us. So the predecessor to me in 2007, she also had her work permit denied. But at that time, the European governments in particular stepped up, intervened, placed the issue on the table. It was a time when Uzbekistan was still under sanctions over Andijan, and the ability of international NGOs to work in Uzbekistan was actually an explicit criteria for lifting of sanctions. And so at that time, there was just more of an appetite to stick up for NGOs and other groups, and there was more pressure. In fact, there were more political prisoners released during the sanctions period than there have been since the lifting of European sanctions at the end of 2009. And as time went on, Uzbekistan became more and more defiant, I think, as it sensed that the appetite to pressure Tashkent was waning in the West. And in 2008, things got a little bit more serious when Uzbekistan actually kicked out my predecessor, declared him a persona non grata. And for a while, we had to change the way we worked in the country. And there were always these sorts of issues. But because it was so important to the local civil society to have the presence of international groups there, we were committed to try again. And it took some time. And when I applied to go to Uzbekistan, it took serious diplomatic pressure just to get a 30-day visa to go to Uzbekistan. I think that says a lot, that nowadays going there for a week or going there for 30 days is a really big deal, which I think should be very shocking. And in the year since I've left, I think things have in certain ways have deteriorated even more. We saw that the employee of the British Embassy in Tashkent, the press secretary whose job it is to liaise with human rights activists, was actually brought up on administrative charges just for meeting with human rights activists. This is a diplomat, technically not someone with diplomatic immunity because he's a local Uzbek citizen, but a longtime employee. And I think that shows that the targets, you know, are changing. Even the diplomatic community and even individual diplomats losing their accreditation, being forced to leave the country if they speak about human rights. I think that should send alarm bells that things aren't getting any better, they're getting worse.
As these changes, as the Uzbek government's position has hardened, evolved, a little bit. What is the feeling among the common Uzbek people within the country about the direction that the government is moving in right now and moving the whole country in at the point? Optimistic, pessimistic, apathetic. What would the average Uzbek say is their situation now compared to a few years ago? And what do they think will happen in the next couple of years? What's their forecast for what things will be like tomorrow, next year, or 2 years down the road?
Well, you know, I think in a society like Uzbekistan, people have their guard up in terms of discussing their political opinions, their feelings about the regime, of course, because that's dangerous. And you sort of penetrate different levels over time as you get to know people. And the first thing that strikes you, I think, is certainly the economic desperation. That the economic situation of people is certainly worse off than it was before. That's communicated in lots of ways. But, you know, there's a sense of, if not openly voiced discontent for the political situation, a sense of stagnation, of isolation. You know, I recall an incident last year in December on the Constitution Day of Uzbekistan. This is in 2010, when out of a country of 28 million people, only 4 civil society activists came out and protested on the city square. And, you know, that showed the courage of these activists. And I should say they were arrested within 15 minutes of doing so. You know, it showed that there's a large group of people that are simply too afraid to voice that discontent. I guess one could argue that everyone's doing fine and that's why there's no protesting. But you sense it in lots of different ways, from taxi drivers that you drive around with that have to wait hours just to get gas, or days just to get their gas tank filled, to, you know, the mother in Karshi, you know, who told me that they've spent days and days without gas and electricity, you know, all sorts of daily struggles that have seemed to have accumulated over the years that show that the situation is bad. And I think there are these other acts of courage, these acts of, for example, there were 2 journalists that went on a hunger strike last year for 18 days. It was amazing. These are people that had worked for the state on state TV, had actually become very successful journalists and had no reason to break with the regime. They had, you know, good incomes. And yet there just came a point when they couldn't deal with the censorship anymore. The fact that as journalists they were being told what to say, despite being successful, they weren't allowed to make basic decisions about what they do in their jobs. And they just grew sick of it and tired and decided at one time we're going to openly protest, and wrote a letter to President Karimov and hoped that he would respond. And you see that a lot. You see, I think, ordinary citizens sometimes writing to Karimov, hoping that he'll step in and do something, which shows, you know, to some degree that there is this desperate hope that that he will wake up, that he has the power to change things, and he will. But as I spoke with these journalists, they started with a letter to Karimov, and they quickly realized that wasn't going to go anywhere, and they quickly turned to a hunger strike and being very public, and you watch that evolution. You know, that's one case where people sort of evolved from placing faith in the authorities to gradually defying them.
Give us an idea, some specific examples of some of the abuses, the human rights abuses that are going on, from, you know, the basics of imprisonment to the more extreme examples of torture, you know, extreme repression against people that have dared to come out in some way or another and incurred the wrath of the Uzbek authorities.
Well, you know, torture is one of those issues that has long been associated with Uzbekistan. When people talk about Uzbekistan, they often start with this case from 10 years ago of a prisoner being boiled alive, immersed in boiling water. This was a case that Human Rights Watch documented back in 2002. And I think to some degree, because the country has been so closed for so long, some officials, some diplomats, some in other places have started to think that maybe torture is a thing of the past in Uzbekistan. But what I can say is that from my firsthand experience on the ground, from morning till night, I was meeting with victims of torture, their relatives, the lawyers that represent them. And one thing that was striking was that it's not just those convicted of or charged with extremism or terrorism that we find are facing torture. I met, for example, a mother of a 17-year-old boy who was picked up for allegedly taking part in a street brawl And in order to get him to confess to an additional crime, the authorities placed a piece of plastic over his face, then covered that with a gas mask and simulated asphyxiation until he signed a confession. And I heard that from one mother. I heard it from another mother who told me almost the exact same story. And I heard, you know, other very graphic stories of torture about people who are convicted or are charged with routine crimes, let's say not political crimes, theft, robbery, things that are not connected with politics. And I think that's a very worrying sign. One thing it does is certainly rebut the argument that torture is on the decline. I think it proves that torture, as it was found in 2002 and 2003 by the UN, is still systematic and is still widespread. And it's something that is of urgent importance and needs to be dealt with by the international community.
That was Human Rights Watch's Uzbekistan researcher Steve Swerdlow speaking with correspondent Bruce Panier.
Just a reminder that The Blender is the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe. RFE brings radio, internet, and television news programming to 21 countries across the former Soviet Union, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, and the Balkans. If you'd like to get in touch, it's very, very easy. Drop us a line at podcast@rferl.org or leave a comment on the Blender section of our website. And remember, you can download episodes of The Blender from our website or by subscribing on iTunes. A new episode is posted every Friday.
The torture endured by a 15-year-old Afghan newlywed at the hands of her in-laws has caused shock and revulsion both inside and outside the country. Correspondent Abu Bakar Sadiq narrates this report on Sahar Ghul's ordeal, which was produced by Radio Free Afghanistan correspondents Bashir Ghazali and Hamid Mohmand in Baghlan and Kabul.
Sahar Ghul screams out in pain from her wheelchair in a hospital in Pulekhumri, the capital of northern Baghlan province, where she first underwent medical treatment after being rescued by local police last week. She was freed from 6 months of married hell, but it is far from a joyous occasion for the 15-year-old newlywed. The bruises and scars that cover her battered body are startling visual evidence of the torture Ghul has endured since being sold into marriage far from home with a man twice her age. Her left eye is nearly sealed shut, her right leg is wrapped in gauze, fingers are broken, and some of her nails have been pulled out. And this is an improvement from just days ago when police found her near death when they arrived to free her from the dark basement where she was held. She can barely muster a reply to a question posed by a local official, Rahima Zarifi.
My father-in-law, sisters-in-law, brother-in-law used to beat me.
What did they used to beat you?
With pliers.
Who pulled out your hair?
My mother-in-law.
Who pulled out your nails?
My mother-in-law.
Ghul's neighbors tell RFRL on condition of anonymity that her in-laws began beating her soon after she arrived from Badakhshan province to marry their 30-year-old son, Ghulam Sakhi, a soldier in the Afghan military. Ghul's father, according to the neighbors, died when she was young and her mother remarried. For a price of $5,000, they say she was handed over as a bride. Some locals suggest she was tortured by her in-laws because they wanted to force her into prostitution. Zarifi, the local director of Women Affairs Ministry in Baghlan, says it is not certain why she was tormented, but that the emotional and physical scars are obvious.
She has been tortured continuously. Every 3 or 4 days she was tortured since marrying some 6 or 7 months ago. Her condition is very bad. When somebody lifts her left hand, she screams loudly. Maybe it is broken. She also has a worsening skin infection. The doctors say it might be contagious. She also has psychological problems and she is very stressed. I think her overall condition is very poor.
After her family in Badakhshan was not allowed to meet or even speak by phone with Gul, they contacted local police. Since being moved to Kabul on December 28th for better medical treatment, Gul's story has attracted national and global attention. The Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission has declared her ordeal to be the worst form of torture. Shamsullah Ahmadzai, the head of Commission's Kabul office, has called on authorities to bring the perpetrators to justice.
We demand that law enforcement and judicial authorities vigorously pursue this case. The perpetrators of such heinous acts should be brought to justice in accordance with the Afghan law.
Afghan officials have announced that they plan to transfer Gul to a hospital in India, and President Hamid Karzai has vowed to punish those responsible. Fazal Rahman, a police officer in Pulekhumri 2nd District, says they have arrested Gul's mother-in-law and sister-in-law and are looking for her brother-in-law and father-in-law. Afghan officials have directed the Defense Ministry to arrest her husband, who is currently serving in southern Helmand Province.
That was correspondent Abubakar Sadiq narrating a report produced by RFERL's Radio Free Afghanistan. And that's all we have for this week. I'm Bruce Jacobs. Thanks for turning on the blender from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Yeah.